Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, Illinois is sitting on a pile of federal money for anti-violence efforts, so why isn't more of it being spent, especially as incidents of gun violence soar? The new state budget provides some help for lower-income college students. More money will be put toward the monetary award program. We'll get the details. The pork industry's fund for marketing and research has been a success through the years. So why have pork producers decided to reduce the amount they give to it? Home health aids are vital for allowing seniors and those with disabilities to remain at home. But getting people to do the work, that's becoming more of a challenge. And we'll hear from a Holocaust survivor who talks about his experiences and why it's important to never forget. These stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, we'll sit down with a Holocaust survivor who shares his memories. We'll learn about the challenge of getting and keeping people in the home health care field. And fans of the Golden Girls recently gathered in Illinois for a convention. That's just some of what's ahead on Statewide. Illinois residents have been suffering through a gun violence crisis that has gotten worse in the last 2 years. The state government is sitting on a pile of extra federal money that could help, but so far, they've not put it to use. Patrick Smith tells us more.
Last month, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker testified before Congress.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairwoman. I want to thank my
He was answering questions about how his administration had been spending billions in federal COVID relief money given to the state as part of the American Rescue Plan Act.
I've governed through this pandemic focused on a central tenet, and that's the role of government in a crisis is to end the crisis as quickly as possible and to alleviate the pain it inflicts on the people that we serve.
Illinois got more than $8 billion through the American Rescue Plan Act, or ARPA. During the hearing, Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy asked the governor about how the state was using some of that money to combat gun violence, which started spiking shortly after the pandemic began in 2020.
Yeah, so let me be clear. We have seen an increase in gun violence across the state in various urban environments. We have to address those problems directly, and putting dollars in helps us to make sure that we're addressing the fundamentals of the causes of crime.
The budget Pritzker signed last year, which covers July 2021 through June 2022, included more than $50 million of the ARPA money for violence prevention efforts. This is a budget that passed in the middle of a gun violence emergency. In Cook County alone, there were more than 1,000 gun homicides in 2021, a record. In November, Pritzker declared gun violence a public health crisis. But the Pritzker administration has just not given out that federal money. Of the $50 million plus allocated to the Illinois Criminal Justice Information Authority for grants to violence prevention organizations, the state has paid out $57,000. It's 0.1%.
Normally, the argument would be, we just don't have the money. Now we have the money, and we're not being diligent about getting the money out.
Illinois State Representative LaShawn Ford represents parts of the western suburbs and Chicago's west side.
Right now, the city of Chicago is on fire with violence, and we have to respond to that. There shouldn't be a delay. You know, people are dying.
When Pritzker set aside the $50 million last year for violence reduction, Reverend Sierra Bates Chamberlain was overjoyed. She'd been pushing with her group Live Free Illinois for the state to spend the federal money on small anti-violence organizations.
It felt like relief was coming, and it felt very hopeful because our communities will begin to get the support that's needed to pull us out of this gun violence pandemic.
Bates Chamberlain shares some of Ford's frustration over the slow pace of getting the money out. But she says the states needed the time to set up an infrastructure to make sure the money is going to the right places and that the organizations are equipped to make good use of it.
I mean, as we know, communities needed the money like yesterday. But on the other end, folks are just trying to figure out like how to make sure that they're getting the money out to the ground and coordinating the funds.
And Leo Smith with the anti-violence organization Chicago CRED says the amount of planning and coordination between government agencies happening right now with the ARPA money is exciting.
We're seeing a major shift from funding individual programs to investing in a comprehensive public health system for violence intervention. And I think almost anyone who is helping out with that shift is frustrated with the speed of it, but I think people are also encouraged by how deliberate it is.
Smith says this is a critical time for community-based violence prevention in Illinois. Support has been building for spending taxpayer money on non-policing solutions to gun violence, but if this money is spent unwisely, it could tank long-term goals.
I think we have to be thinking about this in a three-year cycle so that the public health system is in really, really good shape when ARPA sunsets, so that we really have the case to be made that these resources have been allocated to the best way they possibly can be.
The state has started making moves to get the federal anti-violence money out to organizations. The Illinois Criminal Justice Information Authority has awarded about $12 million to community groups, although no money has gone out yet. Deputy Governor Sol Flores says they're planning to spend about $200 million in ARPA money on anti-violence efforts over the next 3 years, most of it going through the newly created Office of Firearm Violence Prevention.
We've been thinking through a whole of government approach to anti-violence, along with a significant amount of resources that we're investing. And you're right, you know, every death that happens, every violent weekend, you know, we can't do it fast enough, and yet we're doing it. We are listening to what community is saying to us.
She says part of the delay is because they've taken the time to meet with community groups. And Flores says they expect some of the money to be out to community providers before Memorial Day weekend, the unofficial start of summer when gun violence tends to spike.
While it's taken a little longer to implement, we are still on track for the summer. And it's also going to allow us to know, are we moving the needle? Does this make sense? Is this huge investment of cash going to make a difference and save young people's lives?
I don't want to say frustrated. I think we got to have a sense of urgency.
Chico Tillman, the head of the violence prevention organization Ready Chicago, says there is a lot to like about the Pritzker administration's approach to violence. And he understands the state can't be too rash in giving out millions in government money.
You have to be strategic. But the bureaucracy is going to cost lives if we don't move a little swifter.
Hanging over all of this is the fact that the federal dollars have an expiration date. If Illinois doesn't allocate all of the money by 2024 and spend it by 2026, the funds go back to the federal government. I'm Patrick Smith.
An unused facility at Western Illinois University will serve a new purpose. It will be renovated into a center that supporters say will benefit students and the entire region. Rich Egger has details.
An Emergency Operations Center, or EOC, is used as a centralized command facility by emergency agencies, police, and other authorities as they respond to immediate crises such as tornadoes and floods, and during long-term emergencies such as a pandemic. McDonough County's current EOC is temporarily housed in Tanner Hall on Western's Macomb campus, but that building's towering windows could make it a less than ideal place to be during extreme weather with high winds. And Edgar Rodriguez says the region is no stranger to extreme weather.
So we see more natural disaster, more man-made disaster in rural communities, but we don't have the capacity to respond in a precise way like Chicago would do or major cities would do. So this project is bringing those assets to us.
Rodriguez is director of the county's Emergency Services and Disaster Agency. He's excited about the prospect of working out of an up-to-date permanent EOC. It'll be located in the circular former Physical Sciences Library in Curran's Hall. Rodriguez came to Macomb from Fairfax, Virginia, so he's looking forward to the new facility at Western, which he says will be competitive with any other EOC in the nation.
Having that capacity in a rural community is great. The fact that we're going to train the next generation of emergency managers, that's even greater.
That last point is one of the keys to the project.
The thing that I love about this project is that it's going to be an educational EOC. So when we are not using it for emergency purposes, we can train the future emergency managers, because as much as I would like, I'm not going to be eternal. I would like to pass my knowledge to the next generation.
That next generation includes Western Illinois University students studying emergency management. They'll receive hands-on, cutting-edge learning and training opportunities, according to Jill Jolene Myers. She's director of the School of Law Enforcement and Justice Administration at Western. She says the center will be used to train more than students. They will also train professionals
to get them up to date in a region which we are very much underserved.
In addition, the center will meet standards set by the Department of Defense, so it could be used by federal and state emergency agencies, too, if the need arises. The project is estimated to cost up to $4 million. Meyer says half of that amount will come from the federal government.
Hopefully the $2 million will get us so that we can actually move and start it, the operations over there. I guess it would be more work-friendly environment, and we would also then have things that are permanent as opposed to right now. We're kind of shifting things around as need be.
Meyer says she's writing grant applications and seeking other sources of revenue to cover the rest of the cost. She says the project still needs to be designed and put out to bid. She estimates it could be 12 to 18 months before construction begins. Rodriguez says the Macomb Police Department's training room served as the county's previous EOC, so it was not always set up and ready to go. He says the center had been moved to its temporary location by the time of the September 2020 on-campus shooting at Western. He says that event proved a good example of the value of having an emergency operations center that is ready to go in a heartbeat. Rich Egger reporting.
The Occupational Safety and Health Administration has wrapped up its look into the Amazon warehouse collapse in Edwardsville in December. Eric Schmid reports the agency says Amazon did not violate any federal safety regulations.
OSHA opened its investigation after six workers died when a tornado struck the building. It didn't cite Amazon, but investigators did find issues with the way the company notified workers of the danger. The agency issued a hazard alert letter to Amazon with recommendations for how the company can improve safety the next time extreme weather strikes. Doug Parker is an assistant secretary of labor for OSHA.
We're making recommendations because under our standards, there's not a specific citation we can issue in light of the actions that Amazon takes.
OSHA recommends ensuring all workers at a building know where to shelter in extreme weather and that facilities have site-specific emergency plans that account for local weather hazards. I'm Eric Schmid.
A national award-winning Chicago poet has made her home in Rockford. And although she performs spoken word across the country, she still makes time to saturate her community with this art form. Yvonne Booz tells us more.
I speak spoken word while you cast spells.
Goddess Boria the Poet hosted her first poetry slam in Rockford last year. At that time, she says, she wanted to highlight the city, so she brought in poets from across the country.
So many people were coming to me, telling me how much it was needed and necessary and how refreshing it was and how much they wanted to see more of it. And so I decided to stay consistent.
Since then, she's done other things in Rockford. Most recently was the Youth Explosion Talent Showcase. Goddess Warrior the Poet says writing was something she did as a child. She started writing essays in third grade, but in middle school, she grappled with something personal.
I was writing to really get out what I was going through at that time. I was in the middle of my own identity, you know, struggling, learning who I was, dealing with a lot of peer pressure from school, my neighborhood at the time.
She says writing poetry became her form of therapy. As she matured, she developed the courage to transfer her words from the paper to the microphone. Her first spoken word performance allowed her to speak freely about the same thing that prompted her writing in middle school.
I realized that in order for me to be the best artist or the best poet, I had to be my truest self. And it wasn't until I was able to embrace who I really was and on stage so that I could truly be myself off stage too.
She says she did this nervously with her paper in her hand. About a year after transitioning into doing spoken word, she was persuaded to take things a step further and her confidence exploded.
I got into my first poetry slam because people was telling me, oh, you got it. You should do slam. You should slam. And now I have awards for winning slams, but... But yeah, I started out like that.
Slam Poetry is a competition where a group of judges score each performance. There are usually a few rounds before the final winner is announced. Preparing for this experience helped her perform without reading. She started recording her verses and says this technique helped her memorize her pieces. Her first slam poem was called Chirac.
You see, this be Chirac, the city of no brotherly love, where you are lame if you don't drink alcohol or smoke drugs.
Goddess Warrior the Poet says there is one aspect of being a spoken word artist that she isn't that fond of, and that's negotiating pay. But she says her resume allows her to keep thriving.
When you talk about doing this for your purpose and walking in your purpose, that's solely what it's all about. But when you're doing it for the right things, those accolades and achievements, they just fall. They fall in your place, fall in place. It just comes out of nowhere, the same way the pay does.
Goddess Warrior the Poet is a mother with four children, so she understands the work mothers must do. In May of 2021, she released a poetic short film called The Toughest Job. She wrote it for her mom, who she says was her biggest supporter when she was a child.
You know, that still stays with me to this day, and my mother is deceased. But I remember how much she enjoyed me doing what I loved and how much she pushed me. And so I use that today. You know, it's still my fuel.
This role is more than her job. It's her lifestyle. Every other day she's ready to call it quits. But who else could she depend on to feed her kids? Never mind what daddy did.
Goddess Warrior the Poet continues to spread her gift by doing youth workshops and other events in the community. She's collaborating with singer Tina Renee for an R&B show called Ladies of Soul that takes place on May 6th, right before Mother's Day. She is also working on a Juneteenth event in Rockford. The second annual, the Gods and Goddesses Poetry Slam, is scheduled to take place October 8th. Registration opens in July. More information about this and other events involving Goddess Warrior the Poet can be found on her Facebook page. Goddess Warrior the Poet says there is power in writing, and she encourages everyone, especially young people, to write their thoughts down, because you never know when it could turn into a million-dollar idea.
What is it really going to take for the killers to stop?
I'm Yvonne Boone.
But how do we expect to see it when most of these kids have never been exposed to love? Right. You know, a good old home-cooked meal, a warm bath.
There is more to come on Statewide. Why the new state budget will help more kids attend college. Stay with us. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still ahead, why the pork industry plans to give less to its checkoff program. But up next, Governor J.B. Pritzker just signed a nearly $47 billion budget into law. That includes substantial increases to the need-based Student Monetary Award Program, or MAP grants. Peter Medlin talked with the Partnership for College Completion policy manager, Mike Abrahamson, about what it means for Illinois college students.
What were some of your biggest takeaways for what this means for higher ed, and specifically, you know, for students in Illinois?
It sends a message to the state that we're supporting students from low-income backgrounds and being able to access, persist, and complete college. Most specifically, I think the $122 million increase for MAP is going to serve tens of thousands of additional students, and it's going to start us down this path to increasing award amounts as well. They can now award up to, I think it's 50% of public university tuition, which is a significant increase from, I believe, 38%.
I mean, just like how substantial is it, especially compared to like the budgets that we've had over the past couple of years?
Extremely impactful. It aligns with the promise that we had towards $600 million in MAP at this point. And it will have a significant impact on students being able to afford college. But also beyond that, I think like it also sends a message to students, right? I think the unsure nature of funding over the last 10 years at least have really hurt us in Illinois. And it contributes to the declining enrollments that we've seen. We have tens of thousands of fewer students than we had in Illinois 10 years ago.
Okay, so we mentioned the increase to MAP grants. I want to touch on a couple of the other big points from that. There was the 5% increase to universities and community colleges operations budget, just 5% flat, right?
Yes. And that, too, I would say is a step forward, right? Right now, we're figuring out how, as a state, we can have a system that more adequately, equitably, and stably funds our universities. And this continues to support our college and universities as we figure out that system.
There's increases to things like adult education, career and technical scholarships for minority teacher candidates,
I think that the Minority Teachers for Illinois scholarship, that $2.3 million increase, is definitely important to note.
Okay, so let's get to what we've been like hinting around before, which is that, you know, in 2020, the Partnership for College Completion, you guys released a report saying that Illinois needs to change the way that it funds higher ed. And now it looks like Illinois is actually on the path to potentially doing that.
Basically, in Illinois right now, we're one of few states that for the vast majority, I think 99.5% of our funding is given out based heavily on how we gave it out last year, not necessarily on a system that considers what students adequately need. How can we turn this system from being one of the few in the country that really doesn't have much of a system behind it to potentially leading the country in terms of equity?
Is there anything about this conversation we're having about the budget and the impact it has on students, anything about this whole conversation that you think is more important than people might realize if they're just skimming a headline about the budget?
I think that costs in higher education are a difficult problem to grapple with, right? Because students pay for part of it, the state pays for part of it, and federal funds are in play as well. And that difficulty has, I think, made funding more scarce in a lot of states, and I think especially in Illinois over the last 20 years. But I think that the evidence all points to reinvesting in higher education. It's hard to overstate the opportunities that it will give the state if we reinvest in higher education equitably and in, you know, a targeted way. And I think that this budget, we're starting to see that reinvestment. And so, yeah, it's really exciting to see, but we need to, I think, keep our foot on the gas pedal to make sure that we're continuing to invest in our colleges, universities, and our students. We've seen unique disinvestment in our colleges and universities over the last 20 years. And now we're seeing this reinvestment. And I think it's exciting to see.
Right. The headline is don't stop now.
Exactly. Yeah. Because, you know, we have to continue to lower costs to students and to adequately fund universities so that they can serve students. So yes, don't stop now, I think is the message.
That's Mike Abrahamson. He's the policy manager for the Partnership for College Completion. And he spoke with Peter Medlin. Tutors, COVID tests, counselors, many school districts across the state got millions in federal COVID relief dollars to help recover from the effects of remote learning and the ongoing pandemic. But some officials say it's hard to play catch-up when they're having to spend some of that new money on long-existing problems. We hear more from Susie Ahn.
It's recess at Burnham Elementary in West Suburban Cicero. Kids are chasing each other on the blacktop. Some huddle near the fence to chat. Something you don't see? Kids playing on the playground. There isn't one. Second grade teacher Angela Caravetta says social interaction is key to getting kids back on track following remote learning.
They love being outside, but there's not much equipment for them to do because it breaks. Everybody uses it.
The district is spending about $12 million of its $60 million federal COVID relief dollars on building playgrounds and flexible learning spaces for its schools. Anthony Gazzini is with Cicero School District 99. He says you expect to see school playgrounds in many communities, but in a district where 88% of students are from low-income families, they couldn't afford it at all schools. He says the district had tough decisions when it came to making each budget.
We have to save where we can so we can spend where we need to. Sometimes that means you kick a can down the road for something that really should be a priority.
The district has already spent millions on PPE and other COVID-related equipment. It's also spending a large chunk on academic support, including a literacy curriculum. But it's also making plans for new playgrounds, HVAC improvements, and other repairs that aren't directly related to learning loss. The Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief, or ESSER, funds are meant for pandemic-related issues like health and safety, social and emotional learning, and addressing learning loss. Illinois received a total of $7.9 billion, with more dollars funneled to low-income districts. Districts well-resourced and not are prioritizing spending on teachers and counselors, but then plans start to diverge. For the neediest districts, ESSER funds give them the opportunity to finally invest in things that were long overdue before the pandemic. That's a big help, but it eats into money they could be spending in the classroom. Phyllis Jordan is with Future Ed, a think tank at Georgetown University. She's analyzed thousands of plans from around the country and found that the more poverty a district has, the more likely it is to spend on HVAC systems and facility repairs, as well as classroom basics like textbooks.
Those districts were more likely to invest in instructional materials,
than the richer districts. The more affluent districts, their number one academic intervention was summer learning. And certainly poorer districts were spending on that as well. But when it came to priorities, they were prioritizing instructional materials more.
She says the most vulnerable students during the pandemic were those living in poverty, in need of special education or language services. In the thick of remote learning, those long existing disparities were brought to the forefront. Districts that were already behind fell even further during the pandemic. In South Suburban Dalton, administrators are planning for a major overhaul of decades-old windows and HVAC systems. Delnora Winters, Director of Grants and Transportation, is grateful the district can put more money toward academics and mentoring for Black and brown students and wants to spend more, but facility repairs have gone neglected for years. She thinks it's a shame that it took a pandemic to get this kind of money.
Pre-pandemic, it would have been great. And then it maybe it would have helped with the learning loss curve that we were going to enter into in 2020, 2021. It would have been great to have those funds.
Many would agree the federal relief money was necessary for all schools, and that's why more affluent districts got significantly less. But well-resourced districts were already better positioned to take on remote learning. One small suburban district used 60% of its ESSER funds to give staff a $2,000 bonus as a show of support during a heightened teacher and substitute shortage across the nation. Another district says they'll likely be able to make adjustments to permanently hire a new math specialist. The COVID relief dollars must be spent by 2024. Winters doubts Dalton can afford to continue some of their new programs past that time. She says the money is life-changing, but the inequity in education still limits them.
How are we going to sustain some of these programs that we were able to do, but they're going to go away? But they're needed. They're needed for the district. They're needed for the community of students that are struggling.
She says the astronomical federal relief dollars show how far schools need to go before they can catch up. Once that money is gone, she worries what happens next. Susie Ahn, WBEZ News.
When most people think of maple syrup production, Vermont comes to mind. In the Midwest, Wisconsin and Michigan are the biggest producers. But as Katie Pikus with Harvest Public Media reports, there is a lot of untapped potential for maple syrup in the lower Midwest.
It's a chilly day in late February, and Ben Hawks is tapping the first tree of the season.
It's a little higher pitched every time, and it's seeded once you hit that.
Hawks is working in a residential area in Ames, Iowa, with big maple trees that produce lots of sap. For him, this is the best time of year.
This is kind of the first sign of spring for me, you know. Folks are starting to see red-winged blackbirds, turkey vultures are flying north, sap's flowing.
Hawks' business, Front Yard Sugar, relies on residents allowing him to tap their trees. In exchange, they get a free jar of maple syrup, and he sells the rest. After Hawks collects sap, he boils it down to syrup that has a rich, smoky flavor. He'll sell the syrup out of his car and at the brewery he works at. It's all a word-of-mouth business, and Hawks says there's demand.
You know, if I make 100 gallons this year, which I hope to, I expect to be sold out by May 1st. The stuff sells itself.
While Wisconsin and Michigan are two of the top 10 maple producers in the U.S., Iowa, Illinois, and Missouri have traditionally had hobbyists and smaller producers like Hawks. That's partly because those states were historically dominated by oak trees.
Evolutionarily, we had fire on the landscape. There weren't maples.
Jesse Randall is the director of the Forestry Innovation Center at Michigan State University. He says over time, through changes in forest management, like wildfire suppression, maple trees have moved into oak's place. For example, in northeast Iowa, Randall says maple trees are taking over as oak-dominated woodland dies out. And that means the maple syrup industry can grow.
It's just a matter of let's train those individuals how to make syrup, because historically it has not been a big industry.
Near the town of Bankston in northeast Iowa, Brian Wolf and his family first got into maple syrup for fun.
We started back in 2000. We wanted to do something with the children, you know, in the woods. So we started collecting sap and making our own maple syrup for our own home use.
Today, the family runs Big Timber Maple as a part-time business along with their dairy farm. By 2014, demand for their syrup was so high that they began selling in two statewide grocery store chains.
Quite honestly, a lot of people like local. And when they see something, an Iowa product, you know, they reach for that. There's a lot of people support, you know, us locally, and we really appreciate that. We feel as if we got a good product.
Wolf says there's a lot of potential in maple syrup and room for more producers. That's what Hannah Hemmelgarn is looking into in Missouri and Illinois. She's with the University of Missouri Center for Agroforestry. She says there are close to 63 million maple trees in Missouri and southern Illinois alone that are large enough to be tapped.
There's a big opportunity here, and we're not taking advantage of it in a way that I think can both help people to think about the value of maples, both ecologically and economically.
Hemmelgarn says the goal isn't to tap all the maple trees in the region, but to raise awareness of their value. I'm Katie Pikus, Harvest Public Media.
Pork producers are feeling threatened by attempts to change the way they raise their pigs. And that's led them to a surprising move. They're reducing the amount of money they automatically give to the Pork Checkoff, the industry's fund for marketing, education, and research. Jonathan All reports on their gamble.
Back in 2018, California voters passed a ballot measure that shook much of the pork industry. It created animal production space requirements. That means any pork sold in the state has to be from an operation that doesn't confine its pigs to small spaces. That would eliminate most pigs raised in the Midwest, but not all of them. About a dozen small pigs are running around a fenced area on DL Farms in south central Missouri. Dave Busby, the D in DL, only raises about two dozen pigs a year during warm weather months. He says he works hard to make sure his pigs have it good.
I'll get in here with them and sit with them for a while, and they'll come up and talk. I can't imagine if I was a pig, where could you have what they have here? Especially when I open it up and they get to roam a whole lot more. You get to see sides of them that I don't think you'd see at all in a CAFO.
A CAFO is a concentrated animal feeding operation where pigs, cows, or chickens are kept in climate-controlled stalls with almost no room to move. It's how most meat is produced in the U.S., and what makes it both cheap at the grocery store and profitable for producers. Opponents of CAFOs are using state laws, ballot measures, and legal challenges to try and stop it. The pork producers are fighting back by taking money away from the National Pork Checkoff. That's a fund made up of a small percentage of every pound of ham, bacon, and chops produced in the U.S. It goes towards education, research, and marketing to help sell pork. An example is a very successful advertising campaign from the 80s and 90s.
Pork, the other white meat.
But that money is very regulated in how it's used. Bill Even, CEO of the National Pork Board, says one place the rules strictly prohibit it from going toward is lobbying.
Because different people may have different opinions on different legislative topics. That was an area that was excluded from our jurisdiction.
Pork producers have decided lobbying is important. So important that earlier this year they voted to decrease money for the checkoff, that guaranteed money for marketing, education, and research, so that pig farmers would voluntarily give more money for lobbying efforts. Scott Brown is an agricultural economist at the University of Missouri. He says pork producers see a big need to protect against efforts to change their industry.
Rarely in the past did we ever have a situation where you had an industry that was feeling like those from the outside were dictating how their industry should produce a product. And we're seeing a lot more of that today.
Less advertising in exchange for the possibility of more lobbying is good news for some producers.
This is the first time in the history of the world that we have to fight people to feed them.
Scott Hayes is a hog farmer in northeast Missouri. He says he's frustrated by the laws and lawsuits that are challenging the way he raises his 5,000 sows. Fighting back against what he calls ridiculous rules should be the industry's top priority.
That's where we need, you know, producer money to be spent, you know, to guard what we do and so that we can continue to provide a safe, wholesome product for consumers.
Hayes says he will take the money he saves from the pork checkoff fees and voluntarily give it to the lobbying wing of pork producers. But small producers like Dave Busby aren't interested in that trade-off.
I don't want to benefit Smithfield. I don't need to benefit Cargill. These giant producers, they don't need me. They need me to buy their product, but they don't need me.
Busby says he doesn't think any small producer will voluntarily give any money to lobbying and legal efforts.
Well, I'll believe that when when all of us sit down here and agree that they should raise our taxes too. I'm skeptical.
But there aren't many small producers, and the large ones who want more money for lobbying could make it a well-funded endeavor. I'm Jonathan All.
Well, stay tuned. If you're a fan of the Golden Girls TV show, you're not alone. There was proof of that recently right here in Illinois. There's more of Statewide on the way. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still ahead, we'll talk with a Holocaust survivor who says it's important to never forget. Well, hundreds of fans of the show The Golden Girls gathered in Chicago last weekend for what was titled Golden Con. And ahead of that event, Natalie Moore talked with the organizer to find out what makes the show still so popular.
At the beginning of the pandemic, Hulu viewers streamed 11 million hours of Golden Girls. That gave superfan Zach Hudson an idea for Chicago. Create Thank You for Being a Fan, a convention full of inside jokes and a celebration of the spunky senior citizen quartet.
Today, as in the 1980s, we do sometimes push our senior citizens to the side, right? And I know a little bit about that because my day job is I'm a social worker for senior citizens.
Hudson talks to me in between setting up for the festivities. Of course, he's wearing a Golden Girls t-shirt.
A lot of queer folk, such as myself, will feel pushed to the side sometimes, you know, and also we sometimes get in a position to choose our families, which is what the Golden Girls did. You know, Blanche, Rose, and Dorothy were not necessarily related, but they were a family unit.
Picture it. Golden Girls lovers wearing swag, meeting former writers and producers, a rusty anchor stage, a disco ball tonight. And guest stars like character actress Bonnie Bartlett, the rare villain on the show, a bigot.
I'm flattered that the show has been one of the favorites of so many people. I didn't really get it.
She played the haughty novelist Barbara Thorndike, who joined a club that excluded Jews.
The Mortimer Club is restricted.
Barbara, why are you a member of a club like that?
Because they serve a great breakfast and the parking is free. Besides, it's their policy, not mine.
Yeah, but you tolerate it.
Dorothy, I tolerate a lot of things. For instance, I'm tolerating this evening with Rose and Blanche because of my friendship with you.
The actress is 92 years old today and holds a shirt her granddaughter made of what Dorothy told Barbara in that episode. Go to hell.
And you know, when we did the show, there were like three different men who quit. Older men who to play the older Jewish man, and they were insulted. And believe it or not, actors don't quit often.
Golden Girls is remembered for its bravery in tackling such thorny issues considered too taboo for primetime television 4 decades ago. There was the episode where Blanche was confronted with her homophobia, and other episodes that addressed ageism, marriage equality, and AIDS. However, no matter the subject, the foursome always produced laughs. Stan Zimmerman was there at the beginning. He got his first television writing gig for Golden Girls. He worked on season one.
And that's where we kind of learned how to write a funny joke. But we also learned that Bea Arthur didn't need a line to get a laugh. All she had to do was, like, shoot a look.
Convention goers will hear these kinds of behind-the-scenes stories all weekend. Golden Girls is a sitcom that keeps on giving, attracting new generations.
It's real people talking about real feelings and sometimes disagreeing and sometimes not.
Thank you for being a friend. Travel down the road.
Because at the end of the day, it's about four people having each other's back, having fun, and eating cheesecake. Natalie Moore, WBEZ News.
More seniors and people with disabilities are choosing to stay in their homes, and home health aides are vital to providing them basic assistance. They help with tasks like housekeeping, shopping, and bathing. The profession is projected to be one of the fastest growing nationally over the next decade. Side Effects Public Media's Natalie Krebs reports that despite that, recruiting and retaining those workers is getting more challenging.
A lot has changed in Jonathan Miller's life in the past decade, but one thing that's remained consistent is his home. The two-bedroom ranch-style brick house in West Des Moines, Iowa, is filled with Jonathan's art, photos, puzzles, and a lot of University of Iowa gear. He's a big Hawkeyes fan.
Literally everything that you see has come after cancer, where he's collected what he wants, and that's why this is his house.
That's Jonathan's father, Don Miller. He explained Jonathan bought the house in 2007. For 3 years, his son put a lot of work into the fixer-upper. Then, in 2010, he suffered a major stroke. He was 25. The cause was advanced testicular cancer. A year of aggressive therapy saved Jonathan's life against all odds. Don says the whole experience left his son severely brain damaged. As Jonathan chats beside him, Don explains he's legally blind and has difficulty speaking, hearing, and walking.
He can't stand without someone supporting him and guarding him and guiding him, helping him transition into a wheelchair or getting around.
For Jonathan, leaving his home has always been out of the question. Don says this loudly in front of his son, so he can hear.
John's biggest single goal has always been to get to stay in his house.
Don lowers his voice when he starts to talk about how difficult this has become recently. All of the home health agencies responsible for his son's care are understaffed. It means Don and his wife Lori are frequently rushing over to his house, often on short notice, when there's no one available. Don says they're starting to think the unthinkable.
It put us to the spot where we were and are looking at alternatives that would take him out of the home. It's the one thing that he wants.
The main reason for the shortage of home health aides comes down to money. Connie Corcoran is a home health aide who works in central Iowa for an agency run by a hospital. She loves her job.
These people are so appreciative of what you do for them. It keeps them in their home, bottom line.
But Corcoran says it took her 2 decades to start earning $17 an hour. This is the main reason she says she sees so many aides quit.
You can drive by McDonald's and see on their sign what they're offering. And if you have been in direct care for several years and you're not even making that, it makes you feel terrible.
Stephen McCall is a data and policy analyst with PHI, a group that advocates for direct care workers. He says home health aides often don't have any career path, allowing them to move up into other related positions.
That means that their skills that they're developing over time, providing services to older adults and people with disabilities, often go unrecognized and unrewarded.
Recently, some states like Indiana, Iowa, and Minnesota have passed or proposed bills to fund more resources for home health care or increase Medicaid reimbursement rates. The Biden administration has proposed putting billions towards home health care. But Rachel Werner says she doesn't think this is even close enough to the resources needed to tackle this workforce shortage. Werner is a professor of health care management and economics at the University of Pennsylvania.
And it's not clear to me that the country is ready to make that commitment to invest in the long-term care infrastructure. But I think that's a big part of what it would take.
Werner says on top of this, there needs to be a shift culturally in the way society views and values the work of home health care aides. She says that will be even harder to accomplish. Natalie Krebs, Side Effects Public Media.
Side Effects Public Media is a regional reporting collaboration focused on public health. An opinion from the Illinois Supreme Court expands accountability for police officers in the state when they are pursuing suspects. Caroline Kobzanski brings us details.
The Illinois Supreme Court ruled last week that Sauk Village police officers are responsible for a pedestrian who was injured by a man fleeing the police in a stolen car. Attorney Kevin O'Connor represented the injured man. With this ruling, he says police officers will only be immune to injury suits when they have already taken a suspect into custody.
Until the police has their hands on somebody, cuffing somebody, doing something like that, they are not an escaping prisoner. So it's really going to prevent a lot of these wild police chases.
The decision overturns a 2019 appellate ruling that expanded police immunity to cover bystander injuries from police chases. I'm Caroline Kobzanski.
Eric Blaustein is a retired civil engineer who lives in the Chicago suburbs. He's also a survivor of the Holocaust. Blaustein visited Peoria this week to speak at the city's annual Holocaust Remembrance Day at the Peoria Riverfront Museum. Before his speech, he sat down with WCBU's Hannah Alani. And in this interview, Blaustein describes his memories in Europe and reflects on the importance of never forgetting the atrocities that led to World War II.
I grew up in a well-to-do middle-class family. I was a very happy kid because I had everything I wanted. And we went on vacations, and I went to the zoo, I went to the museum. I had a father and a mother who were educated and told me all kinds of stories. I was a happy kid, and I did not know. I have to say I vaguely knew that I was Jewish. I didn't really know what that meant. I was a German kid.
Before the Holocaust, what was life like as a German Jew? Did you practice your holidays openly in your neighborhood with your family?
You could, but we did not. My father was a free thinker, and we had no holidays. As a matter of fact, dimly, I remember we had a picture, my sister and me, under a Christmas tree, because that's what Germans celebrated. Well, all that stuff was thrown out in 1934 when my parents decided, they tell us we are Jews, darn it, we will be Jews.
I know you were arrested at one point after trying to hide.
I was hiding till age 15 and a half, 16, and I was caught only 5 months before the end of the war. They discovered me, and I ended up in a concentration camp. September 44 till April 1945, I was liberated by American troops. I was caught, actually, not because I was Jewish. They thought I was a deserter from the German army. In order not to be hung that same evening, I had to tell them I'm Jewish. It sounds even funny in a way. In order to save my life, I had to tell them I was Jewish.
What did you experience?
Personally, I was even lucky in the concentration camp. At that time, the prisoners had a little control about what's going on in a camp like Buchenwald. And they knew I would be killed the next morning just for sport. There were no Jews anymore in Buchenwald. And they told me, we kill you right now. What they meant is there was a young Italian partisan who had died. They took his number off and put it on my uniform, and my number was put on his uniform. Next morning at the barrel, they put my body out, I was dead. I made it through without being really discovered with the help of some Italian prisoners which claimed that the gibberish I talked was Italian.
What was your journey like from Europe to the United States?
After the declaration of the State of Israel in 1948, I felt I was obliged to do something for my own people. My ethnic people, and I went to Israel. I was a lieutenant in the Israeli army. I stayed in Israel, got married there. But things in Israel were professionally not to my liking. I wanted to build big things. So I had a sister in the United States. I came to the United States in 1954. Eisenhower had started with the Interstate Highway Program. There was so much work for a civil engineer like me that I arrived here on Thursday. The next Monday, I went to work.
Why do you think it's important to remember the Holocaust, and how do you think it should be taught?
Well, there are two things. I don't want to be a Holocaust survivor by definition. I'm an American citizen, and I experienced something horrible, but otherwise I want to live like any other American. On the other hand, knowing about the Holocaust will show people what can happen if you play with anti-anything like that. It doesn't have to be anti-Semitism. It can be anti-Yugoslavian or anti-Greek. We don't want to live in the past. We live in the future. I have three generations of Americans already coming after me. So I feel it's important that people know what happened. I think it will help them to make decisions not to be anti-Semitic.
The world is, it feels so crazy right now. When people ask you, do you have advice for this generation or a message for these people today, what would you say or what comes to mind?
Don't be afraid to show other people that you are Jewish. It might be the best antidote against anti-Semitism.
That's Holocaust survivor Eric Blaustein, and he spoke with Hannah Alani. That's all the time we have for this episode of Statewide. We're glad you could join us and be with us again next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Remember, you can find all of our episodes at the website nprillinois.org. Just look for Statewide. And our weekly podcast can be found through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.